The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Eagles number 11, Pride of Eagles. The McAllister clan has traveled far and wide, but none has traveled harder than Falcon McAllister. Hired by a wealthy cattle baron, Falcon sets out from San Francisco for the town of Laramie, magnificent Arabian horse in tow, and rides into a storm of treachery and murder.
Now don't you go trying to be a hero, mister. I think maybe you better put your gun down and get out of here.
No, I don't think so.
I said, put your gun down, mister. Do it now, or I'll kill her.
I tell you what, you let the lady go, and I won't kill you.
Falcon's words surprised the intruder, and he blinked a couple of times.
What? What did you say?
I said, let the lady go and I won't kill you.
Mister, are you crazy? Do you see that I'm pointing a gun at her?
Exactly. And that's where you made your mistake.
You call this a mistake?
Oh, I do indeed. You see, you're pointing a gun at her, not me. I, on the other hand, am now pointing my gun right at you. I'll count to three. Then I'm gonna kill you.
I warn you, mister. If you start counting, I'm gonna kill her when you get to two.
And I will kill you when I get to three.
Already stalked by a vengeance-crazed Yuma prison escapee, Falcon is distracted by two beautiful women, a seductress with a voice like an angel and a lovely widow with a gift for guns.
It's Kathleen.
Kathleen, is something wrong?
Falcon? Mr. McAllister, are you here?
Yeah.
Why are you hiding?
I'm not exactly hiding. I'm just being cautious.
Why, Mr. McAllister, are you afraid of me?
Why do you ask? Should I be afraid?
I would hope that you're not afraid. After all, I'm just a woman. I thought maybe we might visit.
Do come in.
Meanwhile, a second outlaw lays down a villainous trap. No doubt about it, blood will be shed. When and how is only a matter of one man's swift revenge.
Suddenly, eight mounted horsemen galloped down the middle of the street. They showed no sign to stop.
What in the world's going on? Is that a bunch of drunken cowboys?
I'll tell them to slow down, sure.
Edward started toward the middle of the street to signal.
Deputy, no! It's Johnny Purvis!
You won't want to miss 1 minute as Falcon McAllister blazes a new trail of adventure across the Wild West in Pride of Eagles. Outlanders number 42, Satan's Seed. Nazi time travelers have overshot their destination and are intent on conquering the remains of the post-Nukecost world. Among them is the so-called world's wickedest man.
Who the hell are you?
My name is Alistair Crowley.
Crowley?
You know me.
I know of you.
I am Countess Paula von Schicksal.
Sorry?
I take it that name is not familiar to you.
Afraid not.
But you recognize the name of a fat homosexual drug addict.
Wow, he was famous.
Where are my friends?
The Nipponese and that colonial thug? They are right behind you.
Are you guys all right?
Hell no, we're not all right.
Why is a Nipponese in the company of two Americans?
Why shouldn't he be?
The Japanese are renowned for their long memories. I would not have thought they would ever forget about August 6th, 1945.
What happened then?
You mean you do not know?
Why should I? That was over 260 years ago.
The 200. Year. What year is this?
You're from the past. From World War II or thereabouts, aren't you?
The year and location.
The year is 2203.
How can that be? Lam said we would jump only a century ahead, when the Archons would be in control. That was the plan.
How did you get here?
You would not understand.
Does it have something to do with the Black Sun?
An away team led by Brewster Filboid keeps the Cerberus Warriors alive against all odds.
Something is happening.
As they return to Thunder Isle.
Move, you dumbass!
In Outlanders number 42, Satan's Seed.
Graphic Audio presents
William W. Johnstone's Crusade of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Karen Carbone, Jeff Baker, Tim Carlin, Michael Raplogel, Kate Torrey, James Konacek, Thomas Penny, Sonny Lasky, Michael Glenn, James Lewis, Dylan Lynch, and Mort Shelby.
The cold rain had begun before dawn and continued to slash down on the small relay station that was the last stop before Colorado Springs. Approaching in the night was a large green Concord stage with yellow letters proudly proclaiming the carrier McAllister Stage Line. It was drawn by 8 prancing horses blowing fog in the cold air and driven by a wizened old driver who pulled the team to a halt.
Whoa! Hey, folks, we'll be stopping here for tonight.
6 passengers deboarded the train. 4 men, 1 woman, and her 9-year-old daughter. They were exhausted and grateful for the sparse comfort offered by the way station for the night. Their luggage remained in the tightly lashed leather boot, dry and secure despite the rain that had started this morning.
Oh, there should be late supper stew and biscuits waiting for you inside, supplied by Gullah Andrews, our way station manager. And you'll find the beds are warm and dry.
The window curtain had done little to keep out the rain, and the hard leather seats would be cold and wet again for tomorrow's travel. In the pre-dawn darkness, Loomis Tate sat on a bale of hay eating cold beans from a can, looking through the rain toward the way station that was some 20 yards distant. Loomis was a man of medium height and size, distinguished only by his pockmarked face and a drooping left eye. Matt Logan had climbed up into the loft a little earlier, and he was looking to the east. Logan was tall and thin, almost cadaverous looking. He had an oversized nose. Ron Michaels and Ken Strayhorn were keeping warm in one of the stalls. Michaels was an albino, and even the men who rode with him found him creepy. Strayhorn was short and stocky, with red hair and a bushy beard. Drew Tate was standing in the doorway relieving himself, no more than 6 feet away. Although Drew was Loomis's brother, the two men didn't look anything alike. Drew was almost nice-looking until one looked into his eyes. They were obsidian, almost serpentine. He had a mustache that he groomed daily.
What the hell, Drew? You got no more manners than to piss this close to where a man's eating?
Sorry, I wasn't thinking.
That don't surprise me none. You don't ever think.
It ain't right you talking to me like that. We're brothers.
Only reason we're brothers is because Ma wouldn't let me and Kelly hold your head underwater when you was born.
Yeah, well, still, you got no right to talk to me like that. Kelly don't never talk to me like that.
Yeah, well, Kelly ain't got much more sense than you do.
It's getting light in the east. I reckon they'll be coming out soon.
Get the horses ready. Soon as we get the money, we'll be riding out of here.
How come we don't just hold them up out on the road? I ain't ever heard of robbing a stagecoach before it even leaves the station.
No, and neither's anybody else. Which is exactly why we're doing it this way. Doing it like this means there ain't no chance they can get away from us. And cause we'll catch them by surprise more than likely, they won't put up no fight.
Lights on in the house. These folks moving around inside.
Won't be long now. Get the damn horses ready, I said.
Inside the way station, the kitchen was filled with the rich aroma of coffee and frying bacon. Falcon McAllister was in the kitchen, leaning against the sideboard, drinking coffee as he watched Gullah Andrews and his wife Mary preparing breakfast for the coach passengers.
Normally, we don't allow no passengers in here till breakfast time. But seeing as you ain't just a passenger, but a partner in the stage company, I reckon you're welcome.
Well, I appreciate that, Gully. But if you want me to wait somewhere else, I'll be glad to go back to my room till you call.
No, the only reason I don't like folks in here is because I don't like nobody looking over our shoulder when we're cooking. They keep trying to tell us better ways of doing things.
Gully removed a pan of biscuits from the oven.
If it was me, I'd leave those biscuits in a mite longer.
What? Well, if you don't like the way I make my biscuits, you don't have to eat them.
No, I'll eat your biscuits. Luckily, Mary's gravy would make anybody's biscuits taste good.
I see you know who to flatter, Mr. McAllister.
Mary had been making gravy, and now she poured it into a big bowl.
Mm-hmm. That really looks good.
Gully, breakfast is all ready now.
Billy?
Billy McLean, the coach driver, and Ben Jackson, his shotgun guard, were sitting at the dining table in the next room drinking coffee.
Yeah, all your passengers down. Breakfast is ready.
I'll see to the team.
Ben was in his 50s, a retired Army sergeant who had served all through the Civil War, as well as during several of the Indian campaigns. He'd been with Reno during Custer's last fight. He walked into the kitchen.
You wait until after breakfast if you want, Ben.
No need. I'll just grab me a biscuit and bacon. By the time the folks are finished eating, why, we'll all be ready to go.
Here you go, Ben.
Mary sliced open a biscuit and laid on two thickly cut pieces of bacon. She handed it to the shotgun guard.
Thanks, Mary.
From his place in the barn, Loomis watched the back door of the house open and slam shut. Someone hurried through the rain and the dark.
Here comes someone from the house. Get back out of sight.
Soon, Ben slipped into the barn. He removed a match from a waxed waterproof box to light a kerosene lantern. When the flame was turned up, a small golden bubble of light cast long shadows inside the barn.
Good morning, horses. I hate to get you out of a nice warm stall on a rainy day like this, but we got a long run ahead of us. May as well get started.
It was warm and dry inside the barn, redolent with the aromas of leather, cured wood, horse flesh, and hay. Ben walked over to the first of the 8 horses that would form the hitch for the coach. He was just opening the gate to the stall when he saw someone standing in the shadows.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
Hey, what are you...
Pale hand came out from behind Ben and clamped down on his mouth. Another hand, equally colorless, came around, this one holding a knife. One of the passengers was a whiskey drummer, going to Colorado Springs to sell his wares to the saloons there. Mac Goff was short, with a narrow face and hooked nose. Owen Gilmore, a lawyer, was overweight, red-faced, and sweated a lot. George Poindexter was the third male passenger, and he was young and clean-cut. The lone woman was exceptionally pretty, and her 5-year-old daughter was already showing signs of being just as pretty. Falcon McAllister was the fourth man.
Darling, I just bet you would like one of these sugar cookies I made yesterday. Mrs. Poindexter, is it all right to give her a cookie?
Yes, that's very nice of you. What do you say, Becky?
Thank you.
Mr. McAllister, what's a fella like you riding in a common stage for? Well, I think you'd be riding in your own private coach.
In a way, you might say I'm doing that, since two of my brothers and I own this stage line, Mr. Goff.
I reckon you got a point there.
What brings you to Colorado Springs, Mr. McAllister?
Well, Mrs. Poindexter, I received a letter from a man named James Portalis. He asked that I come discuss some business arrangement with him.
Yes, that would be Count Portalis.
You know him?
My husband and I do business with him. He owns a large dairy, and we sell him milk.
I thought he owned a hotel.
That would be the Broadmoor Casino. Yes, Portalis owns the Broadmoor. It's his attempt to bring culture to the West, I believe.
And you think he won't be successful, Mr. Gilmore?
Have you ever heard the expression, a silk purse from a sow's ear? Any attempt to bring culture to the godforsaken West is akin to making a silk purse from a sow's ear.
Well, I'll withhold judgment till I've met him and seen Broadmoor Casino.
Is Ben coming back in? I have some biscuits and bacon left over, and he likes to take a few with him.
I'll take them to him, although I'm sure he'll be back in. That's his shotgun there, and he's not likely to leave it.
Well, I'll just wrap his biscuit and bacon sandwiches up in a cloth, but you be sure and tell him not to forget.
I'll tell him.
Billy stood up, wiping his mouth on the back of his hand. He picked up a canvas bag with a locked top.
All right, folks. We want to make Colorado Springs by noon. We need to get underway.
Billy and the passengers started toward the door. Falcon stopped short just before he reached it.
Oh, doggone it, I left my hat in my room. Don't leave without me.
It's your stage, Mr. McAllister. I may look dumb, but I ain't dumb enough to leave my boss high and dry.
You ain't likely to leave anyone dry in this weather, Billy.
As Falcon started back to his room, the rest went outside. The stage was standing where it was left the night before, and there was no team attached.
Damn, Ben ain't hooked up the team yet? That's not like it.
As Billy and his passengers started through the rain toward the stage, five men with guns drawn suddenly came from the barn.
Hold it right there, folks.
What is this? Where's Ben?
Ben? That'd be the fella that come out here to hitch up the team?
Yeah.
He's back there in the barn. Seems he sort of stuck his neck out.
Had an artist made a painting of the scene being played out in the yard of the way station, it would have been surreal and gray-washed by the falling rain. On one side of the canvas, there was the barn and stagecoach. On the other side, the house. In between the barn and the house, Loomis and his men formed one line, with the driver and his passengers forming another. Becky stared pointedly at the albino.
Mama, that man has pink eyes.
Hush, dear.
The albino, who had endured a lifetime of stares, said nothing.
Are you the driver?
Yeah. Who are you?
Name is Tate. Tate? Would you be Loomis Tate?
Loomis glanced toward the rotund lawyer, then nodded.
That's me, and I believe I recognize you. Yeah, you lawyer, aren't you? I seen you back during one of my trials. Maybe I should have used you then. My lawyer sure didn't do me no good. I don't do pro bono. Yeah? Well, I don't know what that means, but it don't matter none. The judge had his time scheduled for when I was going to get out of prison, and I had mine.
You escaped from prison, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Loomis nodded toward the bag Billy was carrying.
I take it that bag you're toting over your shoulder is the money shipment?
It's an express bag. I don't have no idea what's in it.
Well, then that makes me smarter than you, don't it? Because I do know what's in it. You're carrying a $10,000 shipment to a fella by the name of James Portless.
I wouldn't know about that.
Toss the bag over.
I don't think I want to do that.
What'd you say?
I'm responsible for this shipment. You're gonna have to take it from me, because I ain't handing it over.
Michaels, you and Strayhorn Brink, what'd you say your friend's name was?
Ben.
Right. You two drag Ben's body out here. I think the driver needs a little convincing.
The albino and Strayhorn put their guns back in their holsters, then went into the barn. A moment later, they came back out, one on each of Ben's legs, dragging his body through the mud behind him.
Mama, what's wrong with that man?
I killed him, darling. Same as I'm gonna kill your mama if the driver doesn't do what we tell him to.
No! Don't hurt my mama!
Becky wrapped her arms around her mother's legs. Her mother pulled Becky's face into her skirt.
Now, Michaels, there ain't no call for you to be scaring a little girl. But it's up to you folks whether or not she sees anyone get killed.
Loomis looked over the group, then pointed at Goff, the whiskey drummer.
You, take that bag off the driver's shoulder and toss it over here to us.
Stay where you are, Goff.
Falcon stood on the porch. Loomis looked over toward the sound of the voice and saw that another man had come from the house, looking down at him. His gun was still in his holster.
What'd you say, mister?
I told Goff to stay where he is. If you want that money pouch, you're gonna have to get it yourself.
What are you butting into this for? It ain't your money.
It ain't yours either.
Yeah, well, it's gonna be mine as soon as I get my hands on it.
Loomis put his gun away and started toward the driver.
Take another step toward that money bag and I'll kill you.
What? Ha! I give you this, mister. You got a lot of gumption bracing us without so much as a gun.
Oh, I have a gun. It's in my holster, just like yours is.
Maybe you didn't notice, mister, but my gun ain't in my holster.
What's your name?
The name is Drew. Drew Tate.
Tate, huh? Would you and Loomis be brothers?
Yep. I see that you heard of me.
No, can't say as I have.
Drew looked shocked and a little chagrined that Falcon had not heard of him. Actually, Falcon had heard of him, but it was part of his mind game to let Drew think that he hadn't.
What do you mean you ain't never heard of me? Why, I killed me seven men. Faced them down, man to man.
Is that a fact? And did you already have your gun in your hand when you did that?
Oh, don't you worry none about that, mister. I put the gun back in my holster and
no!
No? No what?
No, you won't put your gun back in your holster. you try, I'll kill you. If you even twitch, I'll kill you. The only thing you can do now to keep me from killing you is to drop the gun.
Mister, are you crazy? Maybe you ain't never heard of me. But even if I was a nobody, there's two of us holding a gun on you, and you don't even have a gun in your hand.
You are a nobody.
Mister, you're just begging to get yourself killed, aren't you?
Drop the gun or make your play now.
Shoot him, Drew! Shoot him!
Drew moved his thumb to pull back the hammer, but he never made it. Bullet plunged into Drew's chest, causing a red mist to spray out from the entry wound. He stood there for a moment, his face registering more shock than fear or pain. He turned toward Luna.
Ow, big brother. He's killed me.
He lay on his back in the mud, rain falling into his open but sightless eyes.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
Logan dropped his gun and put his hands up.
Logan, you cowardly son of a bitch! Shoot him!
Loomis started for his own gun, but stopped before he even touched it when he saw that Falcon was now pointing his gun at him.
Drop your gun belt! And tell that pasty-faced son of a bitch and that furball with him to do the same thing! Then all of you put your hands up!
Reluctantly, Loomis and the others did as Falcon ordered.
Billy! Get the stage hooked up and take these good folks on into town.
What about you?
Send the sheriff out here with his Black Mariah to pick up his prisoners. I'll ride back with him.
Yes, sir.
Billy looked at his passengers, all of whom were registering some degree of shock over the events of the morning.
You folks get on back inside where it's warm and dry. I'll call you as soon as the team's hitched.
I'll give you a hand.
What about us? Ain't you gonna get us out of the rain?
You can wait in the barn.
Sheriff W.A. Smith closed the cell door, then locked it. Logan, the albino, and Strayhorn went meekly to the bunks and sat down. But Loomis, he remained standing just inside the bars.
Prison didn't hold me before, Sheriff. What makes you think it's gonna hold me this time?
Oh, it won't hold you.
See, you don't think so either, huh? Well, maybe you ain't as dumb as you look.
You won't be going to prison. We'll hang you right here in Colorado Springs.
Hang me? Hang me for what?
I'm sure there's a lot of reasons to hang you. But I knew Ben Jackson. We served some in the Army together, and he was a good man. Fact is, I figure he saved my life more than once. So I'm gonna take particular pleasure in hanging you for killing old Ben.
I didn't kill him. The albino killed him.
Loomis, you squealing son of a bitch.
Oh, don't worry. The albino will hang as well. As a matter of fact, all of you will hang. Because in the eyes of the law, it doesn't matter which one of you done the actual killing. You was all part of it.
That ain't right. That ain't no way right.
It's a little late for you to be worrying about what's right and what's wrong, ain't it? Now, you boys just make yourselves comfortable back here. You won't have to stay for too long. The judge will be coming through next week. He'll try you on Thursday, and why like as not, you'll all four be dead come sunrise on Saturday.
What about McAllister? He killed our pard in cold blood. We seen him do it. You gonna try him as well?
As far as I'm concerned, he just saved the county the cost of a rope. I'll have supper brought back to you in a bit.
Supper? We ain't had our lunch yet.
Oh, didn't I tell you? The county is trying to save money, so you'll only be eating twice a day while you're staying with us. Though if it was up to me, I wouldn't feed you anything. You're all gonna be dead in a few days anyway. There's no way you could starve to death between now and then. Yeah, it would save the county the cost of feeding you.
The sheriff turned and started back toward the front of the jail.
I ain't hanging! You hear that, Sheriff? I ain't hanging!
Sheriff Smith closed the door to the back half of the jail, then saw Falcon McAllister sitting on a bench reading the newspaper. Smith had been surprised when the stagecoach driver told him that McAllister had captured Loomis Tate and his entire band. But what had really shocked him was the driver's description of the gunfight between McAllister and Drew Tate. How Falcon had drawn and killed Drew before Drew could pull back the hammer of his unholstered gun. Sheriff Smith knew that at one time there was a paper out on Falcon McAllister. It came out shortly after Falcon went on a killing spree, avenging the death of his wife and pa. But the killing was clearly justified. The paper had been withdrawn, and McAllister was cleared of all charges.
The last thing he wanted to do was to try and arrest Falcon McAllister. Realizing that the sheriff had been staring at him for some time, Falcon looked up in question.
Is there anything wrong?
No, I was just thinking, that's all.
What were you thinking about?
Well, sir, I know there's a reward for Loomis Tate and his brother Drew, and I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a reward for the others as well.
A reward, huh?
Yes, sir. And unless I miss my guess, it'll be a pretty good reward. Looks like you earned yourself a payday.
I don't want the money.
What do you mean you don't want the money? It's gonna be paid. What do you plan to do with it?
If there's a reward, give it to charity.
What charity?
I don't know. Do you have an orphanage here in Colorado Springs? A children's home or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Of course we do. And that's an excellent idea. You're a good man, Mr. McAllister.
You'd call me Falcon.
Holding up the newspaper, Falcon pointed to an advertisement that ran down the right-hand side of the front page. It read, Broadmoor Dairy, the oldest dairy in Colorado Springs. Babies cry for it, relatives sigh for it. Old folks demand it, all the wise ones get it. Daddy pays for it, mother prays for it. Others crave it, only a few don't get it. Remember, it pays to buy Broadmoor milk and cream, the purest and the best.
Well, this would be James Portless' ad, I take it.
Yeah, I think James would have been much better off to stick with the dairy business. This new thing of his is going to bankrupt him.
You're talking about the Broadmoor Casino?
Oh, not just the Broadmoor. He's also digging a lake and building homes for the wealthy.
Building homes for the wealthy? Not the poor, but the wealthy?
Yeah, he's calling it the Cheyenne Lake and Land Improvement Company. So far, he's put 240 acres of good dairy farm land into it, as well as $9,000 of his own money.
That would explain why he was shipping so much money by stage. I was wondering what he wanted with such a large amount.
Yeah, well, he ought to be particularly grateful to you for saving his money for him. If you have any favors you're wanting to ask of him, I'd say now would be the time.
Nope. Can't think of anything I'd want from him.
But you came here just to see him, right?
Yeah.
Why?
Curious, I guess. He contacted me and said he wanted to discuss a business proposition. I just came to see what it was all about. You don't need me for anything else, do you? I mean about the prisoners.
Nope. Though, before you leave town, if you're serious about giving the reward money to the orphanage, I'd like you to drop by and sign something to that effect.
All right.
Falcon started toward the door.
Falcon.
Yeah?
That's a fine thing you're doing, donating the reward money to charity like that. I'll be sure and let him know where it came from.
You tell him it came from Ben Jackson.
Ben Jackson? Yeah. Yeah, old Ben's got no family, so this'll be a way for folks to remember him. I thank you for that.
Falcon touched the brim of his hat, then stepped outside.
You out there, McAllister? You hear me? I'll get you for this. I'll get you if it's the last thing I do.
Falcon was waiting in the lobby of the hotel when he saw someone come in and stand just inside the door as if looking for someone. The man had neatly combed hair, high forehead, wire-rimmed glasses with narrow lenses, an expansive mustache, and a neatly trimmed beard. He was wearing a dark blue suit with a tie and a white shirt with turned-up collar. Falcon got up from the sofa and walked toward him.
Would you be Count Portless?
I would be if we were in Germany.
Here I am just James Portless. May I take it that you are Mr. McAllister?
Call me Falcon.
Falcon extended his hand.
The actors, Andrew and Rosanna McAllister. I am told they are your brother and sister, is that right?
Yeah, I'm their brother. Do you know them?
Oh, I've never met them, but I have seen them perform, both in my own country and here in America, in New York. They are positively brilliant. You must be very proud of them.
Well, I am proud of them, but I must confess that I'm surprised you know that they're my brother and sister. We don't exactly have the same circle of friends or social contacts.
Oh, I make it a point to find out all I can about people who interest me. And you interest me, Mr. McAllister. In fact, I find your entire family fascinating.
I do have some interesting people in my family, all right.
Come, I have a carriage out front. I'll take you to the Broadmoor, where we can discuss business. I believe it's best discussed over a fine meal.
A Victorian carriage was parked in front of the hotel, its driver sitting on the seat holding the reins of a matching pair of chestnuts. Climbing into the carriage, Portless gave the driver a signal. The team moved out sharply, and they proceeded down Cascade Avenue, gravel hard-packed from a recent roller. Portalus had a pipe clamped to one side of his mouth, and he tamped down the tobacco, then lit it, the aromatic tobacco drifting by the curved arms of his full mustache. He continued his conversation as if there had been no break.
Back to your family. The most fascinating of all, of course, was your father, Jamie Ian McAllister, one of only two survivors from the battle at the Alamo. He and your mother, Kate, pushed deep into uncharted territory that would one day be called Colorado. There he discovered in a long, dry valley, nestled between towering mountains, dark, rich dirt, fed by a wide, deep stream and lush with timber. Today, that is known as McAllister Valley. And since Jamie fathered nine children, a whole brood of blonde-haired, blue-eyed children, who produced another brood of blonde-haired, blue-eyed children, it is literally filled with your brothers and family. They say that in that part of Colorado, that if one shakes a tree, a McAllister will fall out. Am I correct so far?
I feel like I'm at a testimonial dinner.
Well, then let me continue. I never saw your father, but people say that you are the spitting image of him. Not just in looks, but in the way you are. A gunfighter, a gambler, a skilled tracker, a solitary hunter, a formidable foe, a valuable friend, and a man with a strong core of right and wrong. That is why you risked your life to save my money.
Portalus's unabashed praise was beginning to make Falcon uncomfortable.
You'd think I was running for governor or something.
Oh, you would make a very good governor. But forgive me, my friend. It is not my intention to embarrass you. I just wanted you to know that I know who and what you are.
As the carriage turned in through the gate, Falcon was surprised to see a lake placed right in the center of the mesa, with several roads radiating out from it. The dam along the eastern edge of the lake provided visual evidence as to how the lake was formed.
The lake is 300 feet wide by 1,500 feet long. As I develop the property, every house will have a nice view of the lake.
The carriage made a turn so that they were heading directly for a very large building.
And of course, you see here, the Broadmoor Casino.
The building was a two-story wooden structure with a white colonnade across the front. It had large arched windows. The porch, which encircled the top floor, also created a covered walkway on the ground floor.
You can't tell from this perspective, but my guests can enjoy the promenade to view the dramatic scenery to the east. And the back of the top floor faces out over the lake, where there's a boathouse that allows small trips out onto the water.
The grassy garden in front of the building had the word Broadmoor spelled out in flowering plants. The carriage led him out in front of the Broadmoor Casino.
If you'll follow me.
Portalus led Falcon inside. The interior was designed with simple elegance. The large entrance hall was paneled with dark oak. The bar and gaming rooms were to the left of the entrance, along with a spacious area for billiards. The ladies' salon and kitchens were to the right of the entrance, and on the upper floor, two stairways opened directly into the ballroom where concerts could be held. Portalus led him to the second floor.
This is what I want to talk to you about.
Portalus took in the ballroom with a sweep of his hand as they entered.
You want to talk about this room?
Yes. I believe I could put seats enough to hold 1,000 people quite comfortably. What do you think?
The room was exceptionally large, perhaps one of the largest rooms Falcon had ever seen.
Well, I suppose you could.
And the special trains put on to bring visitors to Colorado Springs, I believe I could fill it for at least 10 nights. If I charged $5 per ticket and filled it to capacity for 10 nights, I would gross $50,000. More than enough to pay off the debt on this place.
$5 for a ticket is pretty expensive. What sort of show could you have that would warrant such a charge?
An exceptionally pretty young woman appeared at the ballroom door.
Count Portalus, dinner is ready for you and your guest.
Ah, thank you, Louise. I apologize for calling me Count, but I found that for business purposes, it does give me a certain elan.
Well, sure.
In the dining room, the table was elegantly set with shimmering china, glistening crystal, and shining silver. Dinner was roast beef, roasted potatoes, green beans, rolls, and apple pie. It was over apple pie and coffee that Portalus finally got around to making his proposal.
I want you to see if you can get Andrew and Rosanna McAllister to come here and give assurances place.
Oh, James, I don't know if this...
Would you like to see them again? Don't you think your family would enjoy seeing them again? I could have you and your entire family as my special guests. You would all get royal treatment, have the best seats, and enjoy elegant meals and comfortable rooms. And I'm sure that Andrew and Rosanna would enjoy a trip back to the place of their childhood.
I admit that I would like to see them come back, but their schedule's always so filled.
Oh, that isn't the problem. They merely have to add the Broadmoor to their performance schedule. That's all. Trust me, I am willing to make it well worth their while.
What exactly are you willing to pay to make it worth their while?
30% of everything that the show makes.
50%.
35.
50.
That's not the way you do it. You were supposed to say 45, and I'll count up as 40.
50%.
All right. If you can get them to come here, it will be worth half of whatever I make.
That's a big question, if I can get them. But I'll see what I can do.
Ben Jackson had been a popular man in Colorado Springs. Because of this, the courtroom on Thursday was filled.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This court will now come to order. The Honorable Judge E.A. Colburn presiding. All rise.
Judge Colburn was a small man, but with a persona that was much larger than his size, thus making his presence immediately felt. He moved to the bench with authority, fixing a commanding gaze over the gallery and then sitting down.
Be seated.
Without warning, Eli Crater, the court-appointed attorney, rose from his chair.
Your Honor, as amicus curiae, I must object to having all four men tried at the same time.
Mr. Crater, your objection is denied. Mr. Stubbs, call your first witness.
The prosecuting attorney was C.E. Stubbs.
Yes, Your Honor. The prosecution calls Mr. Billy McLean.
McLean was led to the witness stand, where he placed his right hand on a Bible.
Do you, Billy McLean, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Proceed, Mr. Stubbs.
Your name is Billy McLean, and you were the driver of the stage on the day the murder took place, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And the gentleman who was murdered was who?
Ben Jackson, my shotgun guard.
Why was he murdered?
Objection, Your Honor. Calls for speculation.
Sustained.
Withdraw my question, Your Honor. Mr. McLean, were you carrying anything of value that day?
Yes, sir. We was carrying $9,000 for Mr. Portalus.
Did Loomis Tate, his brother Drew, and their associates attempt to rob you?
Yes, sir. And they would have, too, but Mr. McAllister stopped them.
When was the last time you saw Ben Jackson alive?
Well, sir, we had coffee that morning, and then while the passengers was having their breakfast, Ben went out to the barn to harness the team.
And when was the next time you saw him?
At this point, Billy pointed to the albino and Strayhorn.
When that albino and that redhead drug him out of the barn.
Was he dead then?
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions. Your witness, Counselor.
Crater was a young man who had only recently begun the practice of law. He approached the witness.
Mr. McLean, you said that Mr. Jackson was your shotgun guard. Would you also say he was your friend?
My closest friend.
Is it fair to say, Mr. McLean, that you would like some revenge for his death?
You're damn right I want to see some revenge.
So, in order to get that revenge, is it possible that you might enhance your story?
I don't know what you mean by enhance.
I mean, make your story strong enough to convince the jury that my clients are guilty.
Hell, the sons of bitches are guilty.
No, sir. Mr. McLean, it is not for you to decide whether or not the defendants are guilty.
Crater pointed to the jury box.
That is something these 12 gentlemen must decide. Now, you told the court that you saw Mr. Michaels and Mr. Strayhorn drag Mr. Jackson's body out of the barn. But did you see anyone kill Mr. Jackson?
Yeah, I seen him kill Ben. That's what I've been telling you.
You're lying! You wasn't even in the barn when we killed him.
Order in this court. Mr. Crater, I will ask you to control your client.
Crater winced.
Yes, Your Honor. I put it to you again, Mr. McLean. Did you actually see any of these men kill Mr. Jackson?
Well, no. I mean, not if you're going to put it that way, but I did see...
Thank you. No further questions.
But they done it! Hell, you just now heard Loomis say they done it!
Your Honor, please instruct the witness.
You are excused, Mr. McLean. Say nothing more unless you are asked.
Billy nodded, then glared over at the defense table as he stepped down from the witness chair. After all the witnesses were called and examined, Colburn invited the lawyers to present their summation. Crater was first. He walked over to address the jury, but was silent for several seconds before speaking.
I feel a little like someone who's been ordered to sit in a poker game and play a hand that's already been dealt. It's not an easy hand to play, and if this really was poker, I would fold. But this is real life. I'm a court-appointed defense attorney for these men, and I'm honor-bound to do the best job for them that I can possibly do. But you, gentlemen of the jury, are bound by that same code of honor. If there is the slightest doubt in your mind as to whether or not my clients killed Mr. Jackson, then you must acquit them. Now, you heard Mr. Tate's outcry during my cross-examination of Mr. McLean. It might seem to you that Mr. Tate convicted himself by his words, but I submit to you that that is no more than a disoriented outcry upon hearing McLean say something that he knew was not true. McLean first stated that he had witnessed the killing, then he recanted the statement and said that what he had witnessed was Mr. Jackson's body being dragged from the barn. Without an eyewitness who can testify that he actually saw the act of murder, then we have nothing more than speculation as to who or even how Ben Jackson died. But for all we know, he could have been kicked by a horse, and my clients seized upon that opportunity as a means of extorting the money. Yes, I will grant you that there may have been intent to commit robbery, but no robbery was committed, and we aren't trying for robbery anyway. We are trying for murder, and with no actual eyewitnesses to the event, you cannot, in good conscience, find my clients guilty. Thank you for your patience.
Nervously running his hand through his hair, Crater returned to his chair.
Prosecution, your summation.
Stubbs stood but did not approach the jury.
Your Honor, gentlemen of the jury, ladies and gentlemen of the gallery.
Mr. Stubbs, you know better than to address the gallery.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor. I withdraw my salutation to the gallery. But before I begin my own summation, I would like to congratulate my young and most worthy opponent. As you said, Mr. Crater, you were dealt a very difficult hand, and you played it brilliantly. Brilliantly, sir. And my hat is off to you.
Stubbs made a small bow toward Crater, who nodded back. Stubbs then turned his attention to the jury.
But as brilliant as my opponent was, he was not only dealt a bad hand, he was dealt a losing hand. It is obvious to anyone with any degree of reason that his clients committed this murder. It's not necessary that there be an actual eyewitness to the murder. It is only necessary that there be a preponderance of evidence to enable you to feel, beyond any reasonable doubt, that these men murdered or were complicit in the murder of Ben Jackson. The evidence and testimony presented here today will make that finding very easy for you. I rest my case.
To no one's surprise, the jury found Tate, Logan, Michaels, and Strayhorn guilty. Less than an hour after Judge Colburn entered the courtroom, the four men stood convicted for capital crimes.
Bailiff, would you position the prisoners before the bench for sentencing, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
The four men were brought before the bench. Though Logan, Michaels, and Strayhorn stood with their heads bowed contritely, Loomis Tate stared defiantly at the judge.
Get it over with, old man. I ain't got all day.
Loomis Tate, Matthew Logan, Ron Michaels, and Ken Strayhorn, I hereby order the marshal to lead you to the gallows at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, where the four of you will be hanged by the neck until you are dead. Court is adjourned.
Portless carriage stopped in front of the Denver and Rio Grande Depot. Built of brick, the depot was one of the more impressive-looking buildings in town. It had a red-tiled roof with dormers and a cupola on top from which one could observe the train traffic on the eight sets of tracks that made up the yard.
Wait here with me, Falcon. My driver will make the arrangements. And I do want a chance to once more stress my gratitude for you going to New York on my behalf.
Oh, it's not that much of an imposition, James. I'll enjoy having the opportunity to see my brother and sister again. I've been to New York before.
It's an interesting town.
Oh, indeed it is. I must admit, so, that I'm somewhat surprised you aren't going to stay in town for the hanging this Saturday.
I've seen men hanged. It's not something I enjoy.
Nor do I. But Ben Jackson was a very popular man here, and I think many are going just to satisfy themselves that justice is done.
And nearly as many just to see the spectacle, is my guess.
I can't argue with that. But it's nothing new. The Romans made an art of it with their games in the Colosseum.
The carriage driver returned and gave a ticket to Falcon.
Your luggage has been checked through, Mr. McAllister. It will be in New York when you are.
If it doesn't get on the wrong train in Denver, he'll wind up in San Francisco or New Orleans.
He'll arrive in New York then?
Next Wednesday evening, Count Porteous.
Rest of the week. My, we do live in a marvelous age.
I'll say. It took my pa 3 months to get out here.
Portalus turned in his seat to see the glow of a distant headlamp.
Here it comes.
Falcon nodded, then climbed down from the carriage before reaching back up to shake Portalus's hand.
I'll send you wire as soon as I talk to him.
I hope they will come, but whether they do or not, it has been an honor to have met you.
Likewise.
With a final wave, Falcon started toward the platform, arriving at about the same time as the train. Passing a paper boy, Falcon bought a copy of the Gazette. Took it on the train. There would be no Pullman cars available until he left Denver. The paper, he thought, would help him pass the time.
Four men to be hurled into eternity. Notorious Loomis Tate, one of the men. His brother Drew, killed by Falcon McAllister. Special to the Gazette. In a trial presided over by the Honorable E.A. Coburn, judge of El Paso County, and brilliantly prosecuted by Mr. C.E. Stubbs, the fates of Loomis Tate, Ken Michaels, Ron Strayhorn, and Matthew Logan were placed before a jury of 12 men, good and true. Despite a spirited defense offered by young Eli Crater, all four men were found guilty and sentenced to be hanged on Saturday next at the morning hour of 10. A fifth member of the nefarious gang, one Drew Tate, known for his skill with a pistol, was spared from hanging, because he made the mistake of challenging Falcon McAllister to a gunfight. Drew was dispatched on the spot.
By the time Falcon finished with the newspaper, the train was well out of town and traveling at the speed of more than 25 miles per hour. Falcon leaned back in his seat, put his knees on the seat in front of him, and tipped his hat down over his eyes. Figured he'd better get used to train travel. He had almost a week of it in front of him. The next morning, in Colorado Springs, Matthew Logan paced back and forth in the cell he was sharing with the other three condemned men. At one point, he just stopped his pacing and stared straight ahead at the block wall.
What are you trying to do, Logan? Stare a hole in the wall?
Maybe he thinks he can stare a hole in the wall and we can all just walk through it.
Shut up, Michaels. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be about to get our necks stretched. You're the one should be getting hung, not us. What are they doing that for? That sound's driving me crazy.
You ought to be glad they're testing it out like that, Logan. If they don't get everything just right, why, like as not, you'll just hang there and choke to death.
Or else it'll jerk your head clean off your body. I never thought I'd be hung. I figured I might get shot someday, but I never thought I'd get hung.
We ain't been hung yet.
Loomis was lying on the bunk with his arm across his eyes.
Yeah, but we're gonna be. And I just wish they'd go ahead and do it and get it over with. Stop it! God damn you bastard! Stop!
Any public hanging drew the morbidly curious. But because four were to be executed, this became an event. On the morning appointed, visitors came from far and wide to see the spectacle. Drawing so many that the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad had to add additional trains to accommodate the passenger load. As a result, there were almost as many visitors as there were residents of the town. The gallows stood in the center of town, its grisly shadow stretching under the morning sun. It was just past 9. The hanging wasn't scheduled to take place until 10, and the square was already filled with people. and more continued to crowd in, jostling for position. Several hundred people were gathered around the gallows. Men in suits and work clothes, women in dresses and bonnets, children darting about the square. A few enterprising vendors passed through the crowd selling lemonade, beer, and bear claws. At the jail cell window, some of the older children in the town climbed up on the box and peeked in.
Get away from that boy!
Come on, mister! What's it feel like to know you're fixing to die?
Get away from there now, damn you!
Logan ran toward the window. The boy vanished.
Logan, will you for Christ's sake sit down? You're as nervous as a whore in church.
You don't think I have a right to be nervous? They're about to hang us out there.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Don't this mean nothing to you? How come you're not worried about it?
What good's worrying do?
They're coming for us.
Loomis sat up on the side of his bunk and looked toward the door. He smiled broadly. The man was tall and slim with an oversized handlebar mustache.
Hello, Kelly. You sure as hell took your time getting here.
This is the first chance I had.
Boys, this here's my older brother, Kelly Tate.
Your brother? He sure as hell don't look nothing like you.
Who'd want to look like that ugly bastard?
So, that's why you wasn't worried, huh? Because you got another brother?
Yeah, I figured he'd come get me out.
Oh, am I ever glad to meet you, Kelly. I thought we was going to hang for sure.
We better hurry. If someone finds a guard with his head bashed in, they're going to know something's going on.
You got the horses?
Yeah, they're down at the livery.
You couldn't get them no closer than that?
Not without anyone getting suspicious. But don't worry, there's so many people out there now we could walk right through the middle of the crowd butt naked and nobody'd even notice us.
Well, come on, let's go.
Not yet.
Loomis headed toward the office.
What are you doing? Come on, we gotta get out of here before anybody else shows up.
Don't you think it'd be good if we had our guns?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Kelly was already armed, though there was blood on the butt of his pistol as a result of it being used as a club against the guard. He went over to the drinking water pail and dipped the pistol into it, then used his shirt to clean it off. Loomis returned with the weapons, and they all began strapping them on. After the albino strapped on his own gun, he walked into the office, bent over the body of the deputy, and got his pistol as well. The others followed him in.
What are you doing?
It never hurts to have a second gun.
Loomis spotted some paper and a pencil.
Wait a minute.
What are you gonna do? Write a letter?
Yeah, sort of. How's this sound? To Falcon McAllister. I am going to get even with you for killing my brother like you done. Just you wait and see. Loomis Tate.
Put my name on there, too.
I do that, folks will know you was the one that helped us escape, and they'll figure you're the one who killed the guard.
Shit, Loomis. Ain't none of us gonna get out of this life alive. Put my name on it like I said.
Nodding, Loomis added Kelly Tate to the note. Cautiously, the five men stepped out into the alley behind the jail. Following Loomis, they walked down to the next street, and brazenly joined the crowd.
Hey, Jake, is it true that whenever someone gets hung that their neck stretches out?
Hell yeah, it's true. I seen it myself.
Four of them! Woo-ee! Four of them! By damn, this would be something I can tell my grandkids someday.
Logan's face flashed anger, and he started toward the two men, but Loomis grabbed him and pulled him back.
Maybe you don't got no better sense than to get yourself hung, but I don't intend to let you get me hung. Don't say nothing to nobody. Just keep going till we get out to the horses, then we'll walk them calmly out of town. Soon as we're out, we'll ride like bats out of hell.
Even as Loomis and the others made good their escape, Sheriff Smith was stepping into his office. He didn't see the guard, and from the moment he walked in, he had a strange feeling. It wasn't anything he could put his finger on, but it just didn't seem right.
Leroy? Leroy, where are you? It's time to get the prisoners.
Shit!
Sheriff Smith had left the front door open, and a freshening breeze had blown it shut. Smith's shoulders relaxed as he realized what had happened, and he holstered his gun again.
Christ almighty, Leroy! Will you come out here? You got me drawing on doors now.
Seeing the door open that led back to the cells, Sheriff Smith assumed that Leroy was back with the prisoners. He walked into the back of the building, which housed the cell units, then stopped short. The cell where his prisoners had been kept was empty, the door standing wide open.
What the hell? Leroy! Leroy, where are you?
Pulling his gun again, Sheriff Smith pushed open the back door very slowly and looked out into the alley. He saw nothing.
Leroy, you back here?
Oh, God in heaven.
Sheriff Smith returned to the front office. That was when he glanced over toward Leroy's desk again. This time, because of the angle, he saw something he hadn't seen earlier. A boot was sticking out from behind the desk.
Oh, shit. Please, God, no.
Sheriff walked over for a closer look. His young deputy was lying on his back behind the desk. There was a large, dark wound on top of his head, and a pool of blood spread beneath it.
Oh, Leroy.
Sheriff Smith knelt down to check his condition. He didn't have to put his hand on Leroy's neck to feel for a pulse. He knew, even before he touched him, that the young man was dead. Loomis Tate and the others rode hard after they left Colorado Springs, and by nightfall they were at least 30 miles away. They spent an uneasy night on the ground, then got up at first light the next morning.
Damn, I'm hungry. I ain't ate since breakfast in jail yesterday morning.
God damn, ain't none of us ate.
I know. I was just saying I was hungry, that's all.
Let's get going.
A half an hour later, Loomis's horse suddenly slowed.
Oh, hold up, hold up. My horse has gone lame.
The others looked back toward Loomis and saw that his horse was limping badly.
Where the hell did you get these horses?
From the back of the livery. I couldn't be too choosy. I had to take them where I found them.
You got them from the back lot?
Yeah.
Damn, we'll all be riding cripple horses soon. That's where they turn the horses out that's too old to ride anymore. I wouldn't be surprised if these horses weren't older than we are.
Well, I'm sorry I couldn't bring everyone magical fucking unicorns.
My brother done what he could. Ain't no sense bitching about it now, but we do need to get us some better horses or we're gonna wind up afoot.
Where are you planning to get them?
We need to find us a ranch or a farm somewhere. We'll get us some breakfast there, then take whatever horses we can find. Logan, me and you'll double up on your horse.
Oh, why are you doubling up with me? Why don't you double up with Kelly? He's your brother.
Loomis pulled his pistol and pointed it at Logan.
Of course I could just kill you and take your horse.
No, you can double up with me if you want to.
Yeah, I thought you might see it that way.
Soon they were underway again. With Loomis and Logan riding double, they were not able to travel as fast as they had been before, but it turned out it didn't matter. Because with another mile, we came upon a ranch.
Look down there, boys.
With the sun still low in the east, a soft golden light was falling upon nearly two dozen horses gamboling about in the corral.
I do believe Christmas has come early.
The Rockin' R Ranch belonged to Elam Rafferty. And though it wasn't a particularly large ranch, it was successful because he had a reputation for raising exceptionally good horses that brought premium prices. It also helped that it was a small one-man operation and thus very cost-efficient. Sue Rafferty liked this time of day best, when the air was soft and still early morning cool, and there was a freshness about everything. She saw a few dead blossoms amid the colorful profusion in her flower garden and reminded herself that she would have to do a little puttering later when she had time. Sue continued on out to the barn to call her daughter and son for breakfast. Lucy, her 16-year-old daughter, was milking, while 14-year-old Jimmy was forking hay into the horse's feeding trough. Sue stopped just outside the barn for a moment to watch her children at work. Had grown from being underfoot to being somewhat helpful to being almost indispensable.
Lucy, Jimmy, breakfast is ready.
Good. I'm so hungry I'm about near stove in.
Sure you are. Why, anybody could see that you're just wasting away.
Jimmy was a big boy for his age. He was only 14 years old, but he was already taller than his mother. Good appetite and a lot of work had caused him to bulk up some.
At least I'm not so skinny that I gotta run around in the rain to get wet.
Mama!
Ma!
Mama!
Jimmy, don't do that.
Jimmy and Lucy joined their mother outside the barn, taking in the fresh morning air.
What a coward you are, running to Mama for help. What's the matter? Are you too much of a coward to fight back?
Young man, I'm not raising my daughter to be a common brawler. And I wish I could say the same for you.
What are we having for breakfast?
Bacon, eggs, biscuits, fried potatoes. You and your pa are going to be clearing some pasture land, so you'll be needing a substantial breakfast.
Jimmy put his hand around to the middle of his back.
I don't think I can help him today. I think I must have hurt my back a while ago.
Lucy reached up and flicked her brother on the earlobe, then jumped away from him as he twisted around to try and get her.
It don't look to me like you have a bad back.
You're going to help your pa today, Jimmy, and that's all there is to it. You get washed up and come on in the house for breakfast.
Sue went back to the house, carrying the pail of milk Lucy had gotten, while Lucy and Jimmy stepped over to the pump to wash up. Sue pumped the water for Jimmy as he held his hands under the spout, washing them vigorously with a bar of lye soap. Then Jimmy operated the pump handle for Lucy, stopping just as she got her hands well lathered.
No, don't stop pumping now. Can't you see I got soap on my hands?
What do you give me to pump some more water for you?
Lucy reached up and ran her soapy hands right through Jimmy's hair.
I'll give you a hard time if you don't.
Hey, stop!
Jimmy pumped the handle until Lucy's hands and his hair were free of soap.
Race you to the house!
Marcus, I go! I win!
Yeah, because you cheated.
I did not cheat!
I did not cheat!
Mama, Jimmy said I...
Both kids came to a sudden halt. Their eyes were wide with confusion. There were five strangers in the kitchen. One was short and stocky, with a bushy red beard and hair. He was standing behind their father, holding a gun to his head. Another was medium-sized, pale-skinned with pink eyes. The albino was holding their mother down in a chair with a knife at her throat. A third intruder had pockmarked skin and a drooping eye. He was standing by the table, eating a biscuit and bacon sandwich. The other two were standing by the back wall, almost as if they were observing what was going on, rather than participating in the unfolding drama.
Well now, would you looky at what just come dragging in here?
Mama? Papa, what's going on?
Just do as they say and everything will be all right.
Who are these men?
I know who this one is.
Jimmy pointed to the one with the droopy eye.
You know who I am, do you, boy? How is it you know me?
I seen your picture on a wanted poster once when I was in town. You're Loomis Tate, ain't you?
That's my name, all right. What's your name, boy?
Jimmy. Jimmy Rafferty.
Jimmy Rafferty, is it? You're a pretty smart boy, ain't you, Jimmy Rafferty?
I'm smart enough.
Well, there's one thing I don't need. It's a smart boy.
Ah! You bastard!
Get him off me! Get him off of me!
Greyhorn, who was supposed to have been watching Elam, redeemed himself by stepping over quickly and putting the end of the gun no more than an inch away from Elam's temple. Lucy dropped to her knees and put her hands over her eyes, trying desperately to deny what was before her.
Murderer!
Sue tried to stand up, but the pale-faced one shoved her back down in her chair and cut a nick in her face with the tip of his knife. A bright red stream of blood began flowing from the cut.
Oh, my God! Please, sweet Jesus!
Loomis rose from the floor.
Shut up, woman, or I'll have the albino slit you open from gullet to gizzard.
Sue bit her bottom lip and trembled with terror and grief as she saw both her husband and her son lying dead on the kitchen floor.
You little girl. What's your name?
My name is Lucy.
Well, get up, Lucy. Get over there with your mama.
Lucy did as she was ordered, then reached down and grabbed her mother's hand.
You got any money in this house?
It's over there in the hutch, in the middle drawer.
Loomis went over to the hutch and opened the drawer. He saw some money there, but when he pulled it out and counted, he frowned.
$40? All you have is $40?
Elam didn't believe in keeping much cash in the house. He keeps all our money in the bank.
Well, and $40 and breakfast will have to do. Oh, and we'll be borrowing a few horses when we leave.
barring a few horses, like we're going to bring them back.
Loomis, there's something else here we could use.
What?
The albino looked pointedly at Lucy.
Are you a virgin?
What?
It's a simple question, girlie. Are you a virgin? Have you ever been with a man?
No!
What are you getting at, Michaels?
There's people in Mexico willing to pay a lot of money for white women. And they'll pay just real good for a young virgin girl.
Loomis looked at Lucy and at her mother. Then he shook his head.
No, I ain't going to Mexico till I deal with McAllister.
Whatever you say, I just hate to be wasting these two women.
Don't worry, we ain't going to waste them.
Loomis reached out and put his hand on the neck of Lucy's dress.
Stop it! Please, stop!
Yeah, she's tittied up real good.
What about this one?
Loomis unfastened his belt.
We'll take our turns with both of them. But first, I'm picking a cherry.